next and last stop is Atlantic Avenue, Barclays Center.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Boomer and Geo on the Fan. It's a lot of Nets podcast.
I mean, the only Net fans you know? The only what? The only Nets fans you know?
At least they've got some self-aware.
Man. I mean, come on, man. Or are these guys?
Welcome back to the Only Net Fans You Know podcast. I'm Peter. Charlie is out, but this is a very special edition of the podcast. This is not for the casual fan. Our guest today is a veteran in sports analytics. He's part of the Basketball Index team. The host of Basketball Index's podcast. They use front office level data to provide analysis league-wide. He's the future head of basketball for the Lakers. Welcome to the show, Taylor Wyman.
Hey, man. How's it going? Good to be on. Excited to talk a little Nets basketball.
I love your work as part of Basketball Index. I'm super excited to have you on. And this is just going to be a nice, deep look at the Nets. This is going to be a great episode. And we're just going to jump straight into it. Nets offseason. A lot of uncertainty. They get swept out of the playoffs. We're not sure where this franchise is going. Free agency begins. Dennis Smith Jr. and Lonnie Walker. But what can Net fans expect out of these two guys going into the season?
So I'll start with the good first. So Dennis Smith Jr. is an excellent defensive player. He really popped in our D LeBron, which is just like our overall defensive impact. This is a player that you should be excited about defensively. But the problem is offensively not very strong. So he really can't shoot, doesn't score well. On the bright side, there is some playmaking that comes out of him, setting up potential assists for teammates, things like that. So super strong defender, point of attack defender, not the greatest offensive guy, but I think a really solid rotation piece, you know, someone that can, you know, back up Dinwiddie, whatever it may be. I like that move. I actually think he's one of the better under the radar defensive players in the league. The other guy, Lonnie Walker, he was on the Lakers last year. I saw a lot of him. And Lonnie is a guy that you're going to see some highlights out of him that are really exciting, that like will take your breath away. There'll be a few dunks and transitions, something like that, where he's a really impressive athlete. And he can do some things in isolation where every once in a while you'll be like, oh, wow, that is fantastic. But over the course of a season, not a very good defender, not a great offensive player. Like I said, more of a highlight-oriented guy where the consistency really just isn't there. He popped a little bit in the playoffs, added some value for the Lakers there. So it's one of those guys where he is an interesting guy where you don't mind taking a flyer on him because he is so talented. But so far, what we've seen in his career hasn't really panned out to a positive NBA player. So he is one of those guys, you take a flyer on him, but the highlights are sort of better than the actual play a lot of the time. So of the two guys, I would be a lot more excited about Dennis Smith Jr. as a really high-end defender. Again, not going to score, but if you think of him maybe more of like a defensive specialist, a guy like Matisse Thybulle comes to mind. He was on the Sixers. Now he's on Portland. Really, really high-end defense, not a lot on offense.
Yeah, I saw Dennis Smith Jr. was 10th in the NBA in, I think it was a drive assist percentage. You break down for Nets fans who aren't kind of familiar with that, what that is.
So basically drive assist. So there's like three different driving stats that are like the basic things you look at, where just how often you pass out of a drive, right? Then you can look at how often you pass out for an assist. And then you can kind of combine the two of like of the passes, how many of them go for assists. So like I said, when you watch him play, especially you're going to see on defense, he's a really good athlete. So I think that translates to offense where he can get past his man and he can drive and he can kick, or he can like create a little bit of advantage kind of at the perimeter. The problem with him is he really can't score any of the three levels effectively. So you're going to get some value in the creation department off drives with him, because again, really great athlete, but I think there's a term we use 3-and-D a lot, right? I think on Thinking Basketball, Cody Hodak, one of the hosts there, has 3-and-dimes, which I kind of liked. And Dennis Smith Jr. more fits that profile where it's not 3-and-D, it's not 3-and-dimes, it's D-and-dimes. I can't remember what the name was. I liked it, and I've been trying to work it into my vocabulary lately. But yeah, Dennis Smith Jr., there is going to be some drive and kick to his game, which is nice to complement the defensive value. So again, you're not going to get the spacing out of him, but you do get something offensively. And I think we're seeing that sort of develop in the league because everyone is going after 3-and-D players. Everyone wants them on their roster, but there just aren't that many of guys that are really above average at shooting and defense. So like a guy, Josh Okogie, he was on the Suns last year. They retained him. He's a guy, really good defensive impact, really good offensive rebounder, but again, cannot shoot, cannot space the floor at all. But there is some skill that he has on offense that pops, and that helps kind of float that value on that end of the court where you can keep him, you know, you can play him 20 minutes a game, you know, because he offers you something. Because again, the Dennis Smith Jr. defense, you don't have to worry about that. He's going to be very, very good at that. And it's like, can he provide enough offensive game as a playmaker, as a ball mover to kind of earn those minutes to get into the rotation? That would be my concern with him, but the defensive value, you don't have to be worried about that at all.
We mentioned Lonnie Walker, kind of disappointed me on him. I'm not going to lie, but I did notice from his playoff success, he basically only had one good playoff series, right? The first series he played in two games for just for a couple minutes. He had a big series, against Golden State, I think it was. And then Denver, he kind of reverted back, right?
Yeah, there was sort of a flash there where the Lakers went to the bench. They needed some sort of spark. And again, that is Lonnie's game. Like I said, there's going to be 6 to 10 highlights this year on the Nets where you're going to be like, wow, this guy, we got to be playing this guy 30 minutes a game. We got to be like feeding him. He can shoot the three. He like really impressive leaper, really great athlete. But again, the consistency, unfortunately, just has not been there. And, you know, there have been cases of guys into their mid-20s developing and, you know, taking jumps. It's unlikely, but based on, you know, what you're paying him, it's not like it's a huge contract or anything. There is potential there. And then there are spurts, the ability to come into a game and get hot, which is nice. But yeah, I do have to throw some cold water on Lonnie Walker. The consistency just hasn't been there so far in his career. But the talent absolutely is.
Maybe even the biggest move of the offseason was the Nets re-signing Cam Johnson. What are your thoughts on kind of the contract? Did the Nets overpay? Is it a steal? Is it right in the middle? But what are the analytics and what do the numbers tell us?
So Cam Johnson's a guy I've seen a fair amount on Phoenix, right? And he is a really high-level shooter. I think we saw that two seasons ago. He just shot out of his mind. I know there was a little bit of a regression this season, but Cam Johnson is a really good shooter that has developed into a pretty solid team defender. He's able to, you know, get in passing lanes, rack up some deflections, pretty good at generating some steals when defending on ball. So there's things to like. He fits, I guess, into that 3-and-D archetype a little bit, but we haven't seen him. He doesn't defend on ball a lot. He's been a helper. We have 7 defensive roles here at Basketball Index. Basically, the helper is the guy oftentimes rotating from the corner, guarding shooters in the corner, and then becoming part of the defense as more of a team-level guy instead of being, you know, like a wing stopper or something like that. So he does bring size to the table. He's 6'8". And, you know, like I said, there is some turnover generation, which helps with him defensively, and then offensively, a really strong shooter. The things I'm concerned about with him is his ability to create offense for himself. And we haven't seen that a lot throughout his career. The playmaking really hasn't been there. The finishing data, while he does finish pretty solidly at the rim, he doesn't get to the rim a ton. He's 29th percentile in rim shot creation. Not very good. That's a D in our database. But like I said, when he does get to the rim, he's a pretty good finisher. So I guess the question with Cam is, how, you know, what is the upside, right? How good can he be? The contract was probably a little bit on the high side for me, where, you know, nothing egregious, nothing crazy. Like I said, good team defender and a high-end shooter that, like, the ceiling there as a, you know, catch-and-shoot guy is very, very high. So you like that. But I'm not sure where he's going to add to his game in the self-creation department to exceed the value of the contract. I think that's really my rub with him, is I don't know how or what the road looks like where you're like, wow, this is one of the better contracts in the league. Cause that's, you know, eventually what you want out of your team is you need players playing above their value contract wise, just because of the way the salary cap works. And, you know, he's a pretty, you know, efficient scorer, which is good, but I'm not sure how he ups that to, I don't know, maybe he goes the route of like a Herder on the Kings, where he becomes a movement guy, an off-screen guy, where they're just setting up plays where he's ping-ponging around off ball to get that, you know, the three-point attempts up, because I think that's a way you could get more value out of him because he is such a strong shooter, maybe moving him more. But I like him as a player. He is good, but there is a little hesitancy of like, that was a pretty good chunk of change, and what are the avenues where he could outperform the contract, I think, is the question that comes to mind for me.
What do you think about him possibly being the starting power forward? Is there any hesitancy there?
You have Nick Claxton, which would be your five, right? So I think you would be doing a lot of switching on the perimeter, a lot of hedging, because that's what Nick Claxton is so good at. So you're going to want a strong team defender in your four slot, because if your center is being pulled away from the basket, you're going to need a lot of help defense. You're basically, your whole defense has to rotate over once that happens. He was pretty good this year defending. We have a stat. It's rim points saved per 75. It basically just looks at when you contest shots at the rim, how much are you disrupting? Because like for the longest time, we've had blocks as the only real data point for, is this person difficult to score at the rim? Now we have something, it is called, it's a long name, it's rim defensive field goal percentage versus expected, which is basically what does a guy shoot at the rim when you are coming over to contest shots. So for Cam, it's -3%, which is pretty good, especially for a non-center. So it looks like when he is rotating over and contesting shots, he is being effective. So I think that's the thing, right? When you go a little smaller with your team and you have a shooter at the four like Cam Johnson, your immediate question is, how does this hold up on defense? Because offensively, him at the four is going to make your offense, it's really going to open things up, right? Because you would imagine most guys down the peg from him, your two, your three, they're probably going to be able to shoot as well. And then you have Claxton as your role man, and that really opens things up for the key, where that's probably going to work quite well offensively. Because like I said, Cam Johnson's ability to catch and shoot, very, very high. Defensively, that's where the question is. But last year fared very well protecting at the rim, was very solid there. So I think that's a place to get excited. And that could be another place where you squeeze excess value out of him to try to make that contract better and better. Because if he's rotating at a high level and protecting the rim alongside Nick Claxton, that's a recipe for a solid defense.
You did a whole podcast on it, and you thought the Nets did pretty well considering. Does your rating of the KD trade change when you put into context the contract going forward?
Does that change my... So my view on the trade was, wow, the Nets got a lot back for this. For a guy that was basically forcing his way out, right? And the team was getting... The Nets have been such a strange team the last few years, right? They make the super team. Then there's all the stuff with Kyrie. And then they trade Harden. And then KD wants out. There's just been so much going on, so much to keep track of. That's why we need people like you with a Nets only podcast. There's just so much news. I think it would be bad if they would have lost him in free agency. I think that would have hurt much more than, I'm not going to say any price that you pay him, right? But if you trade for Cam Johnson, because him and Mikal Bridges were the player assets you got in return that were like, oh, these are very solid young players. And if you didn't retain him in free agency, that really would have hurt the value of the trade. So I think re-signing was very good. Like I said, I think the contract was, you know, just a smidge high for me, but like, in the NBA, that's what happens, right? When people get to free agency, people get overpaid all of the time. That's kind of the nature of the beast. So I wouldn't be too concerned with the contract. And I think you're happy to retain your assets because we're seeing in the NBA, it's harder and harder to build through free agency, basically. And I think the more you can retain talented players under 30, the better the situation you're going to be in is.
Mikal Bridges was rated the third best contract in the NBA by Basketball Index. We saw the great numbers he put up coming into Brooklyn. Like you said, his role changed. He became the guy instead of the guy being in the corner, being maybe the third option in Phoenix. He's the first option in Brooklyn. Well, what did the analytics tell us about his offense during his first spurt in Brooklyn?
So Mikal Bridges is an interesting guy, right? Like you talked about it, you set him up perfectly. Off-ball guy in Phoenix comes over to Brooklyn and he's averaging 26 points a game, right? About 30 game sample, not the biggest sample in the world, but historically has been a good three-point shooter. He's about 37, 38% for his career. That's good. He comes over to Brooklyn, puts that up as more of an on-ball guy, which is exciting because basically a good way to think about it is catch and shoot situations are just easier, right? And as you go more on ball, that's going to dip a little bit. That it remained high for him. He increased the amount of threes he was taking, and he was able to keep that three-point percentage right at his career average. That's really good. That's really promising. After that, it's, I don't know, this is going to be interesting. Like I read the rundown you sent me, and I think, he's one of the most interesting cases in the league of the contract he is on is good. If he's just a 3-and-D player with a little bit on top of that, you know, decent mid-range game, can score a little bit more than a guy like Royce O'Neal is a strict 3-and-D guy. You don't really want him putting the ball on the floor and trying to make anything happen beyond catch and shoot threes. Mikal Bridges can do much more than that, right? Pretty solid mid-range game and just a larger player, finishes better. But what's interesting with him is he goes over, his role changes, and then he starts putting up these monster numbers. And that was really exciting. I actually didn't know that he had that in his game, frankly. And for the next 3 years, he's going to be making about, like, on average, I'm pulling it up right now, 3 years, about $23 million a year, which is a really reasonable contract. It's, like, really reasonable money. So if you're going to get a 20-plus-a-game scorer, that's exciting. Like, the analytics field is, like, really not big on looking at, you know, how many points a guy scores a game. Like, it matters, but that's not really the end-all be-all. But at the same time, if you're getting volume scoring on good efficiency, that is always good. That's always something to get excited about. So he comes over, not only does he come over to Brooklyn and he ups the volume quite a bit, like where it's like it was 26 points a game, right? And for his career, he was averaging like 13 points a game. It wasn't nearly as high. It's been a little higher the last few years, but he goes from basically 17 points a game in Phoenix to 26 points a game in Brooklyn. That's a huge jump in volume. Also, his efficiency goes up. He's about league average this year in Phoenix, which a little low for him career-wise, right? And then he jumps up to 4% better than league average, which is really, really good. So this is a guy where it's a small sample, right? It's about 30 games, but already the contract was good as just a 3-and-D guy because he's one of the better 3-and-D guys in the league that could do a little bit more. And now all of a sudden you're like, do we have a star on our hands here, right? He's going into his age 27 season, his prime, and this is going to be one of the more interesting wait-and-see players of next year because it's like, was this real? Is he 25 points a game on positive efficiency? Because if so, along with like, I don't anticipate that it's not like the defense is going to go negative, right? It's still going to be positive. If you have a positive defender on huge volume scoring on positive efficiency, all of a sudden, this is a really intriguing building block player to a championship team in the future. And that's something to be really excited about.
If he does continue this trend, even if he just keeps at the numbers that were at last year, and you, like you said, the defense maybe goes down a little bit, what kind of mold of a player do you see him becoming? On my other podcast, Fireside Nets, my co-host Ben Harris kind of came up with a Kawhi, as you mentioned a couple minutes ago, kind of like a Kawhi Leonard maybe sort of thing. He thought maybe that could be a mold that he could kind of fit into. Well, what do you think?
Okay. So that's a pretty good question. I kind of want to think about that. I understand where he's coming from, right? Where it's like positive defender. They're both wings. They're both long. They both shoot the three pretty well. That was something that was, you know, in their game before becoming a star player. Both started as role players. I don't mind that. I think that that makes sense on its face. A guy that comes to mind oddly for me in terms of last season is it reminds me of Lauri Markkanen a little bit. He was the most improved player on the Jazz. Just in terms of a lot of points, solid three-point shooting. Lauri was a little bit more, he was in a different role. He was like in a stretch big role, right? And he's a little bit bigger of a player. But the thing that comes back to it for me is I'm comparing them in sort of an odd way. Because like if you watch them play, you'd be like, these are not the same player. But the thing with analytics is like you sort of are looking at the value you're getting. And one thing that's going to hold back Mikhail is his inability to play make. And I'm not saying that's something he can't improve on, but he was averaging less than 3 assists a game in Brooklyn while having the ball quite a bit and playing 34 minutes a game. That is really low playmaking. And I think the data point I'm connecting it to with Lauri is Lauri, again, really good stretch big, hit a lot of threes, really good score, but also the playmaking really, really low. And I think the through line with them is it's hard to be a high-end player that doesn't playmake that's not a big, right? Because if you're a big, the playmaking doesn't need to be there because you're going to give like pretty probably monster defensive value if you're a really good big, right? It's kind of naturally how that goes. But I don't know if Mikhail Bridges has like the handle to become a really good playmaker, the ability to probe defenses. I think it sort of, as you get taller, it gets a little bit harder, right? Like if you're like a 6'2", 6'4 guard, easier to have that tighter handle. Mikhail's a little bigger than that. And then obviously Lauri is much, much taller than that. So the through line with them is a lot of points, ability to stretch the floor, but I don't know how either of those guys are going to make their jump in playmaking. I think on some level, you're going to rack up more assists by you just have the ball in your hands more. Your offense is going to run plays and like the Rondo assist thing, right? If you just have the ball all the time and you're delivering it to people coming off screens or whatever it may be, like you're just going to get some amount of assists, right? So I expect it to go up. But in terms of the quality of the shots he's creating for other players, that's something I'm going to be kind of honed in on, and then what kind of volume he can create, because I haven't seen enough of Mikhail Bridges in terms of the ability to create windows when passing to see a viable path to become a good playmaker, right? Where Steve Nash is the ultimate example, where it's like he was throwing balls through windows that like no one even knew existed and he would be getting it to players for open shots. Obviously, you don't need Bridges to be Steve Nash, but you understand the point of the example of I don't see Mikhail creating or moving defenders with his body or with his explosiveness, whatever it may be, or lack of explosiveness. So that for me, I'm looking next year for him and Lauri Markkanen, their ability to up their playmaking to go along with their scoring is something that I'm very interested in. And I don't know what the path forward is for that, but that's, I mean, that's kind of what makes the game interesting is like, if I knew who was going to be good all the time, then I wouldn't need to watch the games. And then you have guys that have crazy breakout seasons. Like I never would have predicted he gets traded and averages 26 a game, right? Never would have predicted that. And then it happens and you're like, okay, this is already a good player. Just got a lot more intriguing.
We could talk about Mikhail Bridges, I feel like, for like another hour.
He's very interesting.
Yeah. I got you on limited time right now, so I got to flip the subject a little bit right now. To me, I say a lot of stuff is very interesting when I'm looking at analytics. I've had some people tell me as recently as yesterday that this guy should not be starting. This guy should be coming off the bench. He doesn't do enough. He's going to be a free agent after next year. Nets should let him go. Nets almost traded him for a first rounder to Toronto, I think about a year or a year and a half ago. But then we look at the analytics, and the analytics tell us that this man is amazing. He's one of the top players in defensive playmaking, which is a stat that you helped make. I'll let you get into that. He's tops in shot blocking, at rim protection. Basketball Index rated him maybe the fourth best rim protector in the NBA. And not only that, shockingly enough, he's an amazing, efficient, off-the-ball scorer. Why is Nick Claxton such a polarizing player to the eye test? Can you dive into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, Nick Claxton. I've been waiting all episode to talk about him. Nick Claxton, I don't know why everyone's not talking about this guy more. So I saw him 2 years ago, and I liked him, right? Where I was like, okay, I understand, like, this guy's 6'11". He's a slimmer build, right? He's listed at 215. I believe that. He's a very skinny guy, but that's kind of the new age big because you need him to be able to hold your own on the perimeter. You need that lateral quickness, right? So I watched him play, and I was like, oh, wow, this guy can really move. I saw him finish a few lobs. Like, I was like, the athleticism here, I absolutely see it. I know why the Nets are going to try to develop this guy, right? Whether it works or not, I see the idea there, right? And then this last year, the first half of the season, right, Durant and Kyrie playing at a really high level. The Nets are looking really good. And I get that Durant and Kyrie are going to get the props, right? They're superstar players. They score a lot of points. But I was like, Claxton fits in really well here as the third best player, like on a championship team. He was really playing at that level. I actually did a podcast. We broke down. So LeBron is our all-in-one metric, right? That looks at like just your total value. It's a really good way to just ballpark a player's value, right? And then you can break that down to O and D LeBron, offensive and defensive, right? And defensively, I thought he had a legitimate case in the first half of the season to be the defensive player of the year. I don't know why people watching him would not like him. His rim protection is elite. It is near the top of the league. His ability to switch out on the perimeter, he was far and away the best switching big in the league. So again, I talked about it before. We have perimeter isolation defense. It looks at how often you lower shot quality and suppress attempts. And he was by far the best big in the league switching out and defending on the perimeter. So you're getting a hyper versatile player. You could play a switching scheme with him, which is all the rage in the NBA right now. He's very good defending out there. And then on top of that, the defensive playmaking, very good. His ability to play in the passing lane, his ability to rack up deflections, intercept passes, great hands. And then the rim protection, where it was like, this is a 2K big. This is a big you make in a lab to fit the modern day NBA. On top of that, the play finishing was outstanding this year. He had an A+ in, we call it very, again, we have very long names for stats here at Basketball Index, stable pick and roll man points per possession. It's like a 12 word stat. Basically what it looks at, stable just means it's padded. So like the new thing to do in stats is to, you pad like 200 attempts or 100 attempts, whatever the stat is, it changes for everyone. A baseline of like what an average player is, because that helps with small sample sizes. And then your points per possession is your shooting and then also your turnovers, right? And then as a roll man, it's your situation where, you know, obviously you set a screen, you roll the basket. So it's your efficiency counting turnovers as a roll man. And then everybody's just padded to league average for some amount of attempts to whatever it be, 50 or 100 attempts, whatever the stat is, to get like a baseline to help with wonky small samples, things like that. He had an A+. He was 99th percentile as a roll man. So again, you're not going to give him the ball. He's not going to score 25 points a game, right? But as a super versatile Swiss Army knife defender who can defend on the perimeter, who can hang with guards, who can protect the rim, who's really bouncy, great on-off numbers defensively, that can finish plays at the rim. He was an A+ in efficiency on putbacks. He was an A+ as a roll man. Like, there is a lot to like. A+ as a transition scorer, where he is an off-ball big offensively that really can succeed around high-end offensive players, which you love. And then I've gone over the defense. This is a player that's like a building block player for a franchise. The people that are saying that he shouldn't be playing are just crazy. They're just frankly crazy. I don't know what else to say.
He's going to be a free agent after this year. What type of contract do you think he might be in line for if he produces anything like last season?
So that's tricky, right? So he had 2 seasons ago, pretty good defensive impact, had a bit of a down year last year in D. LeBron, and then this year was outstanding, was playing at an extremely high level. Like I said, it tailed off in the second half some because on some level, right? So the point of analytics is we're trying to separate out how good players are. We're trying to figure out through data points what a player's value is. And this is an issue in football as well, but it's hard to separate you from your surrounding cast. So if you're on a better team, you're generally just going to have better numbers, right? Like that makes sense. If you're on the Warriors, you're probably going to get some more assisted shots. So that you're probably going to shoot a higher percentage, right? Because of how their offense works and the talent you're playing around. It's the same thing defensively, where Kevin Durant was a really good four that could help protect the rim. Like I said before, if you're going to have Claxton switch out from the perimeter, we were talking about with Cam Johnson earlier, you're going to need someone to rotate behind them. So your teammates are always going to impact your value, right? And his defensive value was absurd in the first half of the season because they were on a really good team, right? The Nets were a high-end team. The second half, not as good, so there was a little bit of a dip in production, but it's hard to separate, you know, was Claxton playing worse or was he just on a worse team? There's more holes to fill defensively, right? But contract-wise, this next season is really important, right? Because if he can play at a high level again, there's some amount of consistency, right? Where it's like, okay, 3 out of 4 years, we've gotten pretty good defensive value out of him. That's what you would think if you're the Nets front office. So this next year really hinges if there's some regression, which is possible. That's going to hurt the dollar amount. But it's looking like I'm willing to go, is this crazy? Am I willing to go like max out contract where it's like, I think right now it's like in the low 30s. If you're going into like what would be your fifth year, like a restricted free agency type situation, I'm pretty sure I'm willing to max him out. If he can generate something near this production, right? He was a slightly above average offensive player, again, as just a good play finisher. And then defensively, the value, like there's not very many defenders in the league you'd probably take over him last season. So I think he will be in the defensive player of the year conversation next year. I think it'll hurt because the Nets probably won't be the top team in the league just based looking at their roster right now. But in terms of just actual defensive impact, he probably will be in that conversation or should be because he was last year. I'm very, very high on Nick Claxton, if you can't tell.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm actually, for people who are listening only to the audio, I had to roll myself back in my chair because I couldn't believe it. But you know what? When I think about it, I was thinking personally around $25 million would not be crazy. So for someone who's high on Nick Claxton, especially when you're looking at the numbers, we know the Nets organization is very big on analytics. I don't think it's that crazy when you start looking at the numbers. If he can repeat what he did last year, I think that's the overall key, right?
Yeah, you're going to need that consistency. So this next season is going to be important and would affect my evaluation of him. I would say a good chunk, right? Because this past season did happen, right? You like that. 2 years ago, you liked what you saw. It wasn't nearly as dominant, but it looked good. Like I said, if you can have 3 good defensive seasons in 4 years, that's something to get really excited about. He was 99th percentile in rim shot making, which basically that stat takes into account your difficulty. It takes into account your shot quality. So he got really good shot quality, again, as a play finisher, but he performed extremely well even on that shot quality, if that makes sense, right? So the quality was good, but his ability to convert those attempts into points was still elite. So that's something that's really, really exciting. And that's something where you're like, okay, there's some amount of skill here. So skill is going to translate when a situation changes, right? Better or worse. If a player has skill, that's obviously what you want because they're going to have the ability to overcome maybe a more difficult situation or whatever it may be. Or when you go to the playoffs and the talent level ramps up, if you know that skill is gonna really help you when things become more difficult.
I'm looking at my clock right now. You got somewhere you got to be. So I just want to give you your plugs and then we're going to sign off.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. On Twitter at Taylor Metrics. If you would like to complain about what I said on this podcast, if you disagree with me, let me know. If you liked what I said, again, at Taylor Metrics on Twitter. If you want to check out the B-Ball Index podcast, I host that. If you like data and you like basketball, that's primarily what we're going to be talking about on there. And then if you just want to check out the site, bballindex.com, Again, it's $5. We have some free tools, but if you want to kind of see everything, it's $5 a month. It's pretty cheap. It's literally the same data that we're selling to front offices and agents. So you can deep dive on Nets players. If there's a trade target you want or a free agent target, you can dive super deep into the data. It's really fun. I spend a lot of time in there. But yeah, Twitter, podcast, and the website, that is the place to find me and the place to find more basketball index data.
At NetFansYouKnow on Twitter, on YouTube, at The Only NetFansYouKnow on Instagram, Monday live show, Fireside Nets with Spen Harris. Have a great night, have a great weekend, whatever the hell you're doing, and let's go. We're out.